It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, one in five teens and young adults live with a mental health condition. UPMC Children's Hospital is developing a new mental health and wellness mobile app to provide personalized support for young adults with behavioral health needs identified by their doctor. Dr. Eva Sigethy is a child and adolescent psychiatrist at UPMC's Children's Hospital and professor of psychiatry and medicine at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Dr. Sigethy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, there are many mental health apps on the market to help with everything from anxiety to sleep deprivation. What makes this new app that's being worked on different from those others?
So there's a number of things that make this new app different. First and foremost is that it is not something that is being sold or provided directly to consumers, but it'll be an app that's prescribed by the teen or young adult's pediatrician and therefore fully integrated into medical care.
Mm-hmm. How do you make the primary physicians, the pediatricians, aware of this, that it might be helpful for their patients?
Well, what's interesting at UPMC is that there's been a real emphasis on screening for anxiety and depression in all age groups, including the pediatric population. And so, in fact, our doctors are very aware that there are rising rates, especially of anxiety, but have been frustrated that they don't have anywhere to refer all of the kids that they're identifying.
Mm-hmm. So what goes into the process of developing such personalized technology, and that's a key to it, is it not, the personalized aspect of this app?
The personalized aspect is key, and it is actually a mammoth process. So you first want to start with a basis of some kind of coping skills, or in this case, cognitive behavioral therapy skills that has some research basis. So it's been shown in other formats, maybe not digital, that it helps kids. Then you need to make sure that how you chunk that information, so the techniques that you're teaching to help kids change how they're thinking, change their behavior so they're not so anxious or depressed, as an example, is provided in a way that it's easy to use, not too big or small in terms of what they have to read on the screen, enough interactive features, and that even things like the background or the images are soothing or something that kids were willing to look at and go back to and use. Then there's the whole technology piece and everything from authentication, security, kinds of problems that you want to make sure that you're ahead of. And then it's integrating it in a way into the medical system that it's easy for providers both to prescribe it, but then also get the information back. Are the kids using this? How are they progressing? What's happening to their anxiety?
Mm-hmm. So that's the development process. So how do you test it to make it to be as effective as you hope it to be?
So there's several layers of testing. First, you start with the development team, and you have versions of the product, and you download it, and you look at it as a team. And we're very fortunate in that our UPMC health plan took the lead in the development of an adult app that we have to make it more user-friendly for teens and young adults. And so we have everything from obviously the engineers, clinicians. We even get feedback from patients and parents. So we really get feedback from a broad array of folks in the testing process. And then each time we get that feedback, we refine accordingly and we test it in another small group, now getting closer and closer approximations to the population where we're rolling it out.
Right. So you alluded to this. I'd like you to explain. So are you building off of adapting an app that's already there for adults?
Yes, we are. So again, with the health of the health plan, we have taken an app. It's a cognitive behavioral therapy program, and actually it's there's a program for anxiety and a program for depression. And the app itself has, again, text information, and then it has interactive pieces. It has audios for example, relaxation techniques, mindfulness techniques, And integrated into the app is a coach who texts with users. And the texting is there to both check in, mm-hmm. are you using the app, how is it going, and to help kids and currently adults use this in a way that makes most sense to their set of problems.
Okay. Let's talk about the set of problems, the personalizing of it. How does that? Because you said there's a lot of information involved that you're trying to learn and glean, but how does it cater to the specific needs of that individual?
So I think that what is important is that the beginning process to get access to this app is that you are screened for anxiety and depression at your pediatrician's office.
Right.
And that then leads to a conversation with the pediatrician being able to put some context on in what situations or circumstances that anxiety or depression is occurring. That information will be made available to our coaches, and our coaches actually are UPMC coaches. So this is all integrated. This is all going to be part of the medical system where kids are getting their care. And so with that information, and then the second part, the texting, I mean, that communication and, you know, teens and young adults and maybe even older adults, mm-hmm. our favorite mode of communication these days are texting. And so it's sort of natural. You know, most Americans have a smartphone and they are very interactive with it throughout the day. So I think that having this, you know, something that you have on you all the time and that you can really turn to and in 5 to 10 minute segments, be able to both learn coping skills, but then have somebody who's monitoring your use, who's interested in how you're progressing and gives you feedback, you know, at the right dose, at the right time, really makes this, I think, very user-friendly and likely to succeed.
All right, user-friendly, likely to succeed. You can make this app as good as possible, but why might you be convinced that teens will actually use it? What will engage them to do it?
So I think that there are three layers to what would engage a teen to use this. One, I think, you know, they themselves are self-reporting a problem to their doctor. Their doctor is telling them that this is something that can help you. And both teens and adults, I think with the help of social media and even the news and all, you know, destigmatizing of problems like anxiety and depression, and also learning that there are helpful things you can do to make those things better, are helping kids reach out and want help. The problem is that there's a national shortage of mental health providers, so licensed psychologists, licensed psychiatrists who can help with these problems,
right,
you know, using medical means. And so having something that allows coaches that can have a broader reach, and there's, you know, the coaches are still checking in and being supervised by licensed clinicians, but that this allows the kids to have access to something that they can, in a somewhat playful way, have available and see their own progress as they move along.
Playful as in games or not?
So the part that we're going to be adapting for adolescents and some of the younger adolescents are ways to sort of track their progress and draw them in ways that it's not a video game,
right,
but it is a way that wants you to try this again, get it better and get better and better at whatever skill you're practicing.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Eva Sigathy, a child and adolescent psychiatrist at UPMC Children's Hospital. According to a study by the Pew Research Center, 7 in 10 teens nationally today see anxiety and depression as major problems among their peers. Are mental health issues on the rise among teens and young adults? And does that figure surprise you or not?
So that figure does not surprise me. I do think that we're getting better at detecting mental health problems. And also, I think with the awareness and destigmatization of mental health problems, more kids are willing to, you know, let somebody know that they're struggling.
Mm-hmm. According to that same study, concern about mental health among teens cuts across gender, racial, socioeconomic lines. Do you find that to be the case here in the Pittsburgh area, patients, et cetera?
Yes, I think that anxiety, depression are equal opportunity disorders. And I think that, we still have some work to do to make screening and these types of interventions available to all segments of our population.
All right. We have just less than 2 minutes left. So kids are criticized for being on their cell phones a little bit too much, and yet this involves them being on their cell phones. So what makes this a different experience?
You're absolutely right. We don't want to take away from real social opportunities, because I think that is important for kids to learn how to cope in the world. But why this is different is that it is integrated into their medical care. The coach is helping them use these techniques. When you're in the app, that's what you're doing. You're either learning a new technique or practicing it, again, with the assistance of your coach. And then your information that you're providing, both how your anxiety is or isn't improving, how far you've progressed in the app, is being sent to your pediatrician so that they can also monitor your progress with you.
Okay. I understand you're starting with a certain number of patients. So what are your short-term goals and what are your hopes long-term, a few years down the road?
Short-term goals are that we get teens and young adults to engage, use the app, progress, and improve their anxiety. Long-term goals are to expand past a small testing group and make this very broadly available.
Dr. Eva Sigethy is a child and adolescent psychiatrist at UPMC Children's Hospital, Director of Behavioral Health with the Chief Medical and Science Office at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. 6 animals tested positive for rabies in Allegheny County this year, but how much do we actually know about this disease? The Pittsburgh Center for Victims has been doing the work of alerting survivors of violent crime about their perpetrator's time frame for release from jail for years. Now the center has created an app that keeps victims informed through every step of the legal process. And former Vice President Joe Biden visited Pittsburgh yesterday to mark the first rally of his presidential campaign. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
It was supposed to be a special year for the legacy of Woodstock, which celebrates its 50th anniversary this summer. At least 2 new Woodstocks were planned for this summer, one an intimate evening taking place on the original grounds with a handful of performers in a screening of the Woodstock movie, and the other a full-blown modern music festival featuring some of the biggest acts of today along with a few artists who performed at the original Woodstock. That event was canceled yesterday by its investors, who claimed that the production was not up to par for the Woodstock brand. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last week, a rabid raccoon was found in Frick Park, making it the 6th animal to test positive for the disease in Allegheny County this year. For our occasional series, A Moment of Science, 90.5 WESA's Sarah Bowden visited Mount Lebanon, where 2 rabid raccoons were found last year. She wanted to learn how much people know about this disease.
Did you know that untreated rabies in people is actually almost always fatal?
No, I didn't know that, actually. That's really scary.
Do you know how to recognize the disease in people or wild animals?
In wild animals, I know it's odd behavior. Like if a raccoon comes right up to you, that's not good. In people, no, I don't.
That makes sense. There hasn't been a case in Pennsylvania since 1984.
Yeah. Wow. Wow, that's good to know. That's very good to know.
That was Christian Pelfrey, Patty Finnerty, and James Francis. Sarah Bowden also sat down with Kristen Mertz, an epidemiologist with the County Health Department, to learn how rabies affects people.
The County Health Department notifies the media when an animal tests positive for rabies. Why do you think this information is important for the community to have?
Because we want to be sure that the community avoids wild animals because they are at risk for having rabies. And also, if there is a rabid animal, we want to make sure the public knows about it in case they have come in contact with that animal.
How does the disease progress through the body?
Well, the virus usually enters the skin through a bite or a scratch, and then it gets into the muscle, and then it gets into the nerves, and it works its way up along the nervous system into the brain and the spinal cord. After it multiplies in the brain, it then spreads to the salivary glands. That's why you'll find the rabies virus in the saliva of a rabid animal.
As the disease progresses, what are some symptoms that you'll start seeing?
Oftentimes there's no symptoms for a while. The incubation period, or the time between when you get bitten and the time you develop symptoms, can be very long. It can be as short as a few weeks and can be as long as years.
That's kind of scary that you could have it for so long. Can you cure it if it's been in the incubation period for that long?
If you get the vaccine, immunoglobulin in the vaccine right away, you're almost certain not to get rabies. If you wait longer, you have a chance. If you wait until you develop symptoms, you're almost sure to die from the disease.
What are the symptoms?
Sometimes you'll get some tingling or a strange feeling at the site of the bite initially, and then you may develop flu-like symptoms like fever, weakness, headache. But then you go on to develop more serious neurological symptoms like confusion, delirium, even seizures. One classic symptom is fear of water. Occasionally people will get more of a paralysis-like picture, but usually it's more of an agitated, confused state. So any wild animal that bites a person, a mammal, we like to test it.
Are there places on the body where a bite is more or less serious, like the face versus the foot?
Yes, the most serious type of bite is a deep wound to the face. So the closer you get bit to the brain, the faster the virus will travel to the brain and you'll become symptomatic. The bites to the lower extremities take the longest for the virus to get up to the brain, so you have more time to get the rabies vaccine.
Thank you so much for your time today. This was really interesting.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate the opportunity.
That was Kristen Mertz, an epidemiologist with the Allegheny County Health Department, speaking with WESA's Sarah Bowden. Find more from our series, A Moment of Science, at WESA.fm. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. An estimated 40,000 people will participate in the various events surrounding the 2019 Pittsburgh Marathon. During this week, we're exploring some of the stories of the runners. 35-year-old Matt Scaletti is a resident of Hampton, and he's running the marathon May 5th. He might say, big deal. Lots of 35-year-olds run the marathon. Matt will run the course while wearing an 11-pound vest to honor the 11 Pittsburghers killed in the Tree of Life Synagogue mass shooting. Matt joins us now to talk about this challenge. Matt, welcome to The Confluence.
Great to be here. Thank you, Kevin.
Matt, among other feats of physical endurance, you've competed on American Ninja Warrior.
Mm-hmm.
You biked 250 miles in 24 hours in Australia. Last year, was it?
Yeah, last year. Yeah.
Okay. So, but I understand this is your first full marathon. Compared to those other challenges, this should be a breeze, right?
No, I don't think it's going to be a breeze at all. It's going to be a different, challenging event, and I've never done any sort of distance running like this in my life. So, especially not with an 11-pound weight vest on. So, it's going to be very different, very challenging, but I'm looking forward to it.
So, why your first full marathon?
I love the city of Pittsburgh, and when something like that happened last October, I was just trying to figure out a way to use my love for fitness combined with my love for Pittsburgh and human beings in general, and figure out a way that I could give back.
You know, you could have worn some sort of T-shirt, you know, honoring the 11, but why the 11-pound weight?
I got a chance to meet the rabbi at the Tree of Life a few weeks ago, and just to see the pain that that community is still going through, I figured they're going to be going through pain for a long time. The least I could do is go through some pain and difficulty for 4.5 to 5 hours during this event.
So it's your first full marathon.
That's right.
You've been training, obviously, by doing some distance running.
Right.
Are you training with the vest, and if so, where?
I'm training with the vest, and actually, we go to a gym up in Hampton, Planet Fitness, and it's been funny, some of the looks that I've got wearing this weight vest on the treadmill in the gym. I also do a lot of my longer runs outside at North Park. So I'm up to 20-plus miles 2 weeks ago. I also had somebody who I know very well who decided to tail me during the one run that I had, and she happens to be here today, my wife, Stephanie.
That's your biggest supporter.
She certainly is.
So, Steph, let me ask you, have you run a marathon before?
Absolutely not. The furthest I've run is a half marathon in 2012, and I call that my one and done event.
You've overcome a major challenge in your life. You're a leukemia survivor. You're director of support services for a young adult cancer support program. So you're obviously an inspiration for young adults battling cancer. How's it feel to inspire them, but also to inspire the guys next to you, your husband Matt?
It's the best feeling in the world. I truly feel like I have the luckiest job in the planet, because not only have I overcome something so tragic and so terrible, but I was able to create such a beautiful meaning out of it. So not only have I built the community for young adults with cancer, I married my best friend who also does these fitness events, which he's raised almost probably $75,000 for the program. So it's the best position that I never thought would come true. It is truly a dream that I get to live every single day.
So what do you want people to see, to think about when Matt crosses the finish line wearing that weighted vest to honor the Tree of Life victims?
The message is, when you give back and you do more, it's the most rewarding feeling in the world. And I think to give back, give love, support each other, and just be a team in Pittsburgh instead of competing. The marathon is a competition, but we really don't see it that way. We're just trying to make a message out of it. We hope everyone finds that meaning as he's crossing that finish line and sees the weighted vest, and just find something within themselves to do something better for themselves and the community.
Matt, besides exhaustion, what do you think you'll feel regarding your mission in this run with the 11-pound vest?
I think when I cross the finish line, it is that mission of love conquering all. And I think hate can win in the short term, but if you look over the long haul, human beings are still here. We're not going anywhere. And that proves to me that love will always be more powerful than hate. And I think that's the message that I want to put out there for everybody that sees me cross the finish line.
Matt and Stephanie Scaletti, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. Since the 1980s, the Pittsburgh Center for Victims has been working with the Allegheny County Jail to alert survivors of violent crime when their perpetrators are released from jail. Now the center has an app to keep victims informed through every step of that legal process. It's called Full Circle. Lori McDonald is the president and CEO of the Pittsburgh Center for Victims. Lori, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Megan.
So prior to Full Circle, how did the center notify victims when their perpetrators were about to be released from the county jail?
We have had a contract with the Allegheny County Jail for probably 25 years, wherein we work with the jail, and as somebody is arrested, I use domestic violence because it's the one that people seem to understand the best, mm-hmm. but if somebody's arrested as a perpetrator of domestic violence and taken to the jail, we interface with the victim every 2 hours. The jail calls us and tells us where the perpetrator is in the process, and we call the victim and explain where they are and where they'll be next, and most importantly, when they're released.
And all of that has always traditionally been done by phone.
That's correct.
So the center's been providing the service for many years. What made you want to modernize it?
You know, several years back, the economy wasn't so good, and our funding was less than it normally was. And so, you know, we had a staff meeting one day and trying to figure out how to do this project more cost-effectively, because it's 24/7. So I made a joke and said, you know, there should be an app for this. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, we ended up getting an anonymous donation from someone. It was a significant donation, and so we decided that's what we wanted to do with that money. We were going to develop the app. So we worked with some graduate students from Carnegie Mellon University who were working with human interface with technology, and they helped us to design the product. And of course, they were graduate students, and then they were gone. And so we got this significant donation, and we went to TrueFit, which is a company here in Pittsburgh that provides software solutions. When you have a really great idea, they'll help you make it happen. And Darren Grove and Jeff Forster at TrueFit have been working with us for, it seems like, years, trying to make sure that this app is absolutely as foolproof as it can be.
What is that process like, developing an app for a human services component? Would you like to see more of those out there?
Absolutely. You know, human services does not interface very much with technology. I'm willing to bet that it's been just in the last 5 years that we've actually stopped doing reporting on paper. We also know that our victims that we serve, especially in domestic violence, are normally between the ages of 18 and 44. Those young folks don't care that much about a phone call, don't have home hard lines. Their world is in the palm of their hand. And so we want to make it as easy as possible for them to get the notifications they need to be safe.
So how does the app itself actually work, and what does it do?
On our side, the victim calls the hotline and gets the app and a passcode and all those things they need to be safe, because the app is kind of hidden on your phone. You can't really tell what it is. So anybody who saw it who didn't know what it was would say, oh, that's just a shopping app. So that's just a little extra safety measure.
And done by design.
And done by design, correct. So when the victim does open the app, they are able to receive push notifications from our advocates every 2 hours, the same way as we did when we were doing it manually and with paper. And we can still do it that way for people who don't want to do it on a cell phone. So we don't want anybody to think that they can't do it the other way.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble is that every 2 hours we call, you've been in a crisis situation, you can't sleep, you're laying there, you're worried about your kids, and you have to wait 2 hours to ask another question. So this app was developed with the idea in mind that we would provide all sorts of information in that app. So we'll send you a push notification and say something like, he's being taken to arraignment. And of course, the victim will say, oh, thank you. What is arraignment? So we have this little information button that you can push, and it'll explain what the process is. That's our job as victim service providers, is to provide victims with the information that they need to be safe and as required by the law, the victims' rights laws.
Who would you say are your usual clients? What have they been through? Why is this service so important for them, especially in those early moments as their perpetrator is going through the criminal justice system?
Well, we know, research tells us that 75% of domestic violence homicides happen immediately after jail release. So that is the most lethal time in a situation for the victim. So we want to give them the tools they need to be safe. So when we call and say he's been released, they know to implement their safety plan and do what they need to do to make sure they and their children, their loved ones are safe.
Is it mostly just about safety for the victim to be better informed about that judicial process?
It is. Nothing is foolproof. You know, when somebody is really intent on harming somebody, nothing's going to, we talk about PFAs not working, and this, you know, this is a tool for safety. It's not foolproof. But any extra time we can give a victim to ensure that they're safe is life-saving. And again, you know, there's all sorts of information. People want to know in the middle of the night, do I have to pay Center for Victims? Do I need a lawyer? Do I have to go to court? You know, all these things run through your mind as a victim, and all that information is in the app.
What are some of those other features and services? I know you mentioned there's a glossary of terms. Crisis hotline?
Crisis hotline is an immediate button to go immediately to our 24-hour hotline if you really need to speak to somebody. The app also gives us the opportunity to push information to the victim. For example, on Monday morning, you need to be in PFA court at 9, and Sue will meet you.
So for someone using the app, what does it look like? How do they navigate it? And does it feel personal? And you mentioned, you know, to the outside user, it might look a little bit like a shopping app.
Right.
How do they navigate it? And is there a way for them to kind of learn with someone before they get started?
Sure. Our hotline advocates are trained to teach people how to use it over the phone. But many times a legal advocate meets a victim at a scene, wherever it may have happened. And so in that case, the legal advocates can set them up right there and tell them how to use it.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, joined in studio by Lori McDonald, President and CEO of the Pittsburgh Center for Victims. Lori, do you anticipate more people could ultimately seek out your services, they or their loved ones, now that it's maybe a little less cumbersome to get these updates in real time?
Yeah, it's interesting that you would ask that question because we have had calls from victims who say, I want that app.
And I want to clarify for our listeners, you're talking about someone that's maybe that isn't going to be in a long stay, either in a jail facility or a prison facility, right?
Right. It's the first step in their incarceration. They've been arrested. They've not been convicted of any crime, but they've been arrested.
The center's new Full Circle app is intended to keep victims safe. State lawmakers are close to approving an amendment to the Pennsylvania Constitution, known as Marcy's Law, that would give victims the right to be notified about or attend or weigh in during plea hearings, sentencings, parole proceedings for their perpetrators. Why do you think, whether it's through this app or through Marcy's Law, that access to that information is so vital to survivors of violent crime?
You know, it's interesting because in 2000, Pennsylvania passed what it was called the Crime Victims' Rights Act. That afforded crime victims a lot more rights to be there when an adjudication is made of some sort or somebody's released on their own recognizance. It also made sure the victims have a right to sit in the courtroom, that they have a right to comment on the sentencing. That never happened before. It wasn't a right. And in Pennsylvania now, the Crime Victims Act is a statutory act, which means that the legislature wrote the laws and they can be amended. If it's a constitutional amendment, it can't be amended or discarded as quite as easily. In a criminal justice system, the perpetrator has constitutional rights. The victim does not. The victim's rights are statutory. So this is an effort to level the playing field, to ensure that victims have strong rights just like the perpetrator does.
You know, opponents of Marcy's Law, including the ACLU of Pennsylvania, say that it could undermine due process. That's the right to a fair and speedy trial for criminal defendants. What would you say to those opponents?
If it was your sister, your brother, your mother, and they didn't have an opportunity to ensure that they were safe, you probably would feel differently about that.
If the Senate approves Marcy's Law, it could be on the November ballot for voters to decide whether it should be part of our Constitution. What would you have those potential future voters know?
Marcy's Law is a really important law. In a courtroom, the perpetrator has many more rights than the victim. If you're a perpetrator, you're provided with a public defendant. The judge is required to not take sides, and the victim is standing there alone if we're not there with them. I'm sure there are many people who don't even know that the victim has no support in a courtroom unless somebody like Center for Victims or other crime victim services are there with them.
Speaking of changes to our legislative process, since the beginning of April, the State House and Senate have approved a dozen victim rights bills. The House passed bills now move to the Senate. The Senate approved measures now go to the House. The legislation includes restricting cross-examining rape survivors, eliminating the statute of limitations for child sexual abuse, making it easier for people with intellectual abilities to testify in court. Are you hopeful in seeing, you know, so many of these measures passed, at least prematurely passed, that more change could be coming?
You know, it's funny because I've been doing this for a very long time. And, you know, when you look back on your career like that, you think, has anything really changed? And I have to tell you, I'm very proud to tell you that I think things have changed a lot in the last 20 years, especially in terms of victims' rights. The world is different now. We look through a trauma lens when we deal with people. And 20 years ago, that wasn't even discussed. So I think that this emphasis on understanding people's unresolved trauma, allowing victims to be heard, I think the reason we've heard so many people come out and talk about their victimization as a child is a direct result of everybody recognizing it's okay. Let's talk about it. Let's make this go away for you so you can enjoy your life. And, you know, I talk with people in hospitals all the time who are administrators or social workers, whatever, and they understand trauma a lot more, too. So I think we're making progress in all the right directions. Let's just make sure the playing field is leveled.
Lori McDonald is the president and CEO of the Pittsburgh Center for Victims, which has just unveiled a new app called Full Circle. It alerts victims of violent crime when their perpetrators are released from jail. Lori, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Megan.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Former Vice President Joe Biden came to Pittsburgh Monday to hold the first rally of his 2020 campaign after announcing his candidacy through an online video last Thursday. Chris Potter is the editor and lead reporter for WESA's Politics and Government Accountability team. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Kevin.
All right, so Chris, why did Biden pick Pittsburgh to launch his ground campaign?
I mean, any number of reasons. One, I think he really does like Pittsburgh. He was here three times last year alone. He's been a mainstay at Labor Day parades. Clearly, Pennsylvania is an important state in the Electoral College, an important state in 2020 that Donald Trump won narrowly, and that may have been the difference maker there. But I think also there's a deeper thing here, which is sort of philosophically about the kind of Democrat that Joe Biden is counting on to win. He's looking for the kind of Democrats who were voting for Conor Lamb last year, sort of working class Democrats, union members, and he's really trying to curry favor with union voters. And that's why he came to a town that is, in many ways, at least in popular imagination, a union town.
So the setting for the rally, a union hall in Lawrenceville, a kind of cozy setting for Biden, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, he's obviously very comfortable with labor. And earlier that day, the International Association of Firefighters came out and endorsed him. This is the first major union endorsement to come in for a Democrat, and they got behind Joe Biden. So it was all about kind of his union ties. He made a lot of references to unions in the course of his speech. It's a cozy environment in a few ways. There were only a few hundred people that they could fit into the room, and there were a heck of a lot of TV cameras. So it was a very comfortable ground for him.
All right. So what was his message to labor at this rally?
I've got your back. I mean, I think that's really what the message was there, is I've been with you for all of these many years, and I'm going to continue to that. And there was really this argument that sort of we have in this country, there's been a breaking of faith between employers and workers, and the tables have been tilted too much on the side of corporations. This is a typical kind of economic populist message that Democrats have been offering for a long time. I think, too, from at least the firefighters who are very much his allies in front and center. He was Harold Schaeferger, the president. I have to be careful with that name. It's like one vowel from disaster. said one of the reasons we're for Joe Biden is I'm concerned that some of these other Democrats in the field are just they're taking the party too far to the left, and we will lose the support of my members. The firefighters did not endorse a candidate in 2016, and a lot of their members did not vote for Hillary Clinton. And so this argument, I think, kind of implicit from Biden but explicit from his supporters, is we've got to keep these folks in the fold, not just the firefighters per se, but other kind of white working class people who broke for Trump in 2016, and we need to bring them back. And there'll be a very spirited debate about whether doing that means costing you other portions of the Democratic base.
He specifically referenced the closing of the GM plant in Lordstown. He also brought up locally the battle between SEIU and UPMC.
Yeah, he said at one point, UPMC, stop union busting. He definitely did try to localize these issues as examples of this broader question of who's realizing the gains, the economic gains in this society. The stock market's going up. Do you feel better about that? And it's an interesting question, because I think you could argue we're in a period of very low unemployment here. A lot of people probably do feel better off. But I think his argument is that so many of those gains have been so concentrated at the upper echelons, and the rest of society is just kind of getting by.
We have just a minute left, Chris. So the two best known names, Democratic contenders, have been in Pittsburgh in the last 2 weeks, Bernie Sanders, now Joe Biden. Are we expecting any of the other 18 to come to Pennsylvania anytime soon?
I don't know that there's another candidate on the schedule coming to the Pittsburgh area, right. But I talked to Nancy Patton Mills, the state party chair. And she said, you know, there's nobody on the radar right now, but she's expecting a lot of attention. Obviously, we've got a long way to go between now and the Democratic primary in this state next year. And everybody believes this is going to be a real decision, a real battleground.
And speaking of which, President Trump, any planned visits to Pennsylvania? He barely won, but it was an important win in Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Val DiGiorgio, the state party chair for Republicans, was asked this question on a conference call yesterday, said he didn't know that there wasn't anything coming on the radar again, but that he knew, having talked to the Trump campaign, who was in the state with concerns about how that state was trending, he does expect a lot of attention from Donald Trump in the months ahead.
Chris Potter is the editor of WESA's Politics and Government Accountability team. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, May 1st is May Day. It means different things in different parts of the world, from a day to acknowledge workers' rights and advocate for justice to a time to celebrate spring. We'll look at how Pittsburghers mark May Day. If you missed anything from today's program, if you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, assistance by Julia Zenkovic. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.